welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. As ever, I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and thank you for joining me again this week for another episode looking at an Oscar Best Picture winner. In this instance, we're looking at, you know, one of the most famous, I think it's fair to say, it's Casablanca. And I'm absolutely delighted to be joined on the podcast for the first time by Mr. Andy Wolverton. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Carl.
How's it going, Andy? I mean, attentive listeners will recognise your voice, I think, because last year you recorded a nice introduction to The Night of the Hunter for me, but it's really nice to have the chance to talk to you properly tonight, as it were.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure to do that intro for Night of the Hunter, which is one of my favorites, and I feel like it's one of the favorites of a lot of listeners of your show, and it's a real pleasure to be here for an extended version.
Excellent. So let's just kind of introduce you a bit more, because I think a lot of people listening will follow you online, but not everybody will by any means. So obviously you're a huge classic film fan, Andy, and I know you do a bit of writing, don't you? And you have your own website where you write about films. So perhaps you could just tell us a little about that.
Sure. I do a blog called Journeys in Darkness and Light, and you can find that blog at andywolverton.com. That includes the blog, and it does focus a good bit on classic film, especially film noir, but I also cover other types of movies as well. And I also have some of my writing about movies, my library presentations that I do at the public library where I work, some of the podcasts I've been on, including this one.
Yep.
And yeah, so it's a little bit of everything.
Great stuff. And I was going to follow up with, you mentioned the library there. So first of all, what part of the country are you in, Andy? Because I know you're on Eastern Time, but I don't know exactly what state you're in. So where are you based?
Sure. Actually, the library I work in is called the Severna Park Library, and that's in Anne Arundel County, Maryland. And for people in the UK that want to know where that is, that's basically halfway between Baltimore and Washington, D.C.
And I know from following you online that you have this film club that you kind of – is it you run it, or you run it with somebody else, and you kind of screen a new film each week, or a different film each week, I should say?
Well, actually, we do. I had a coworker that was doing this with me, and she got another job, and so I'm doing it all now, which I'm glad to do, and I do miss her. She did a great job. But we show basically a what we call – it's called the Great Movie Series, and it's not always a movie from the classic era. We do some more modern films, but it is something that we consider – or now I consider a great film. We do that every first Thursday at the library, and then we also do a lot of special things. Yesterday, actually, we did what we call an Epic Saturday. Mm-hmm. And Epic Saturdays are movies that run a little bit longer than what we're able to show on a Thursday night. And so yesterday we showed Metropolis, the restored version. Had a great time with that, had a great audience with that. So I basically show as many movies as my branch manager will allow me to show. I'd love to do it every week, but I don't think I can get away with that.
Yeah. Well, if I'm ever in town, I'm definitely stopping by. But no, it sounds really fun. So like, do you have like a faithful kind of following, or do you see different people all the time, or what?
I think we do have a core group that comes pretty much every time. And we can go from anywhere from 20 to 50 people in attendance. And our library is not huge, but I'm really impressed that that many people want to come out and see a classic movie. And yesterday I told them, I'm really impressed that so many people came out to see a movie that's 92 years old.
Yeah, it's incredible. Really good stuff. And just before we move on, we should mention, I think, The Dark Pages, which is people who heard the episode I did with Karen Burroughs Hansberry will remember me talking about. But you're part of the team that works on that magazine as well, aren't you?
Yes, I contributed a couple of things to the magazine maybe a couple of years ago. And Karen was very, very gracious and asked if I would be a staff writer. And I was blown away, because I think the magazine is just great. And if you're a film noir person, film noir fan, and you're not reading The Dark Pages, there's some really great stuff. This month, the November-December issue, actually the last one of 2018, is a giant issue. It's 44 pages, and it's all about film noir couples. And there's just some great stuff in there. And one of your former guests, as far as Karen as well, has an article in here. Raquel Stetcher, I know, has been on your show. She has an article in here. Just really, really great writers. I'm just really honored to be in their presence.
All right, then. So We're going to talk about Casablanca, but as I said at the outset, you know, this is part of like an Oscars mini season I'm doing. So Casablanca, of course, the Best Picture winner. It triumphed at the 16th Academy Awards, which was held in 1944. And it also won, I think, Best Director for Michael Curtiz and Best Screenplay as well. So had a decent night at the Oscars that year. I mean, Andy, what do you make of the Oscars generally? Are you a fan of the Oscars? Do you kind of spend a lot of time following them or not?
You know, Carl, I used to keep up with it religiously. And I these days I like keeping up with the Oscar race.
Yeah.
But I don't watch the ceremony. And I always tell people that ask me, they say, you're such a movie fan. How can you not watch the Oscars? And I always say, I can watch two movies in the time that it takes for the Oscars to air. So that's usually what I do. But I do like watching the highlights the next day. And I do try to see all the films that are nominated in the major categories. And but I'm usually, when it's all said and done, I'm usually more interested in the movies that didn't win. Or maybe even the movies that didn't even get nominated.
Yeah, I think I'm the same. First of all, I don't watch the ceremony anymore, but it's mainly because I no longer have access to the channel that screens the Oscars over here. So I follow it online, and you know, they show the highlights the following night and stuff like that. But I do the same. I kind of try and tick off all the Best Picture nominees, make sure I've seen all those. Plus, if there are any other key films where, you know, they've got a lot of acting nominations or whatever, I try and see as much as I can. But all right, then. So let's turn our thoughts to Casablanca. So I believe you said to me this was actually the first or one of the first films you screened at the library. Is that correct?
Actually, it was the very first one we screened. And I chose it because, well, I actually started the group because at the library I would see so many people checking out classic movies on DVD. And I thought, if they're checking them out, maybe they'll come to the library and watch them. And I have to do something a little bit different. So I decided to give a brief introduction to each film and then screen the film and then talk afterwards to get the audience response, but also talk about why does this movie still matter? Why are we still watching it? And what does it say to us today? And I think Casablanca is maybe the best film I've ever chosen for that, because it speaks so much to, you know, it's really timeless. It speaks to our era, but it also spoke to our parents' era. Our children and grandchildren are probably still going to be talking about Casablanca because it really addresses so many timeless issues.
And it always seems to like provoke a very deep and like emotional response, I think. And like, I've seen the film like quite a few times over the years, but I've seen it once on the big screen. And there are sort of two things I remember about that screening is that when the film began, you know, they have that voiceover at the start, and you see that globe kind of revolving on screen. And I remember that there was some like kind of ironic laughter when that came up.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I hope this audience is going to enjoy this film. I hope it's not going to be like this all the way through. But that quickly kind of dissipated and went to one side. And it seemed like people really enjoyed the film, you know. And the second thing I remember is that this was like a small independent cinema, and a guy had arranged to have a marriage proposal to his girlfriend kind of flash up on the screen.
Oh, wow.
As the end credits kind of rolled. And I don't know, that's kind of high risk.
That's a lot of pressure.
But, well, she said yes, it seems. So,
oh, good.
That's good. But no, I think, you know, this is a great film in my opinion, though. It's a popular classic, and I think it deserves, you know, that status. You know, very entertaining, first of all, isn't it? I mean, just as a slice of entertainment, you can't go wrong with this one, I think.
Yeah, totally. It's so entertaining, and it does so many things. You know, it's got romance, it's got action, it's got humor, it's got a tragedy. I mean, everything is in it. Everything you could, and I hope later on we can talk about the different writers that worked on it, how all these elements came together. But it really is a complete package of all of those things.
Mm. And like as an exemplar of like a studio system film, you know, I think one of the great like Warner Brothers films, but also like an excellent example of the weird kind of process here, the kind of alchemy where, you know, lots of things just come together perfectly here. And you know, I don't want to say the film emerged by accident, because I don't think that's true, because I think a lot of hard work and, you know, a lot of preparation, a lot of thought went into it. But when you read the back, kind of behind the scenes stuff, there were some kind of happy events that took place in the making of this film, is what I understand. Is that what you've heard too?
Yes. It, you know, in some ways, the film is kind of odd because it did have so many different, if you read about it, you'll run across all these quote unquote happy accidents that happened. And I think one of them was that the script ever made it to Hal Wallace's desk at the time when it did. I mean, it hit his desk about 4 or 5 days before Pearl Harbor. And, you know, if it had hit his desk a week or two before that, we probably wouldn't be talking about this right now. So there's that happy accident. So many others that we'll probably get to. You know, you think about it, it's really amazing because this film was based on a play that was unproduced. Mm. Nobody knew this play, and it had never been able to get off the ground. But, you know, Wallace took a look at it, and it was so timely because of World War II, Pearl Harbor, that it really was the right thing at the right time.
Absolutely. And just before we leave the topic of Oscars to one side, I mean, let's just look at that Best Picture category for that year. Now, this was in the days when there were more Best Picture nominees, and then subsequently they went down to 5, didn't they? Mm-hmm. And then in recent years, it's come back up again. They can have up to 10, I think, these days. But Casablanca was chosen over For Whom the Bell Tolls, Heaven Can Wait, The Human Comedy, In Which We Serve, Madame Curie, The More the Merrier, The Oxbow Incident, The Song of Bernadette, and Watch on the Rhine. So I guess the question is, I mean, I haven't seen all of those films, to be honest. I've seen a fair few of them. But was Casablanca a deserving winner out of that bunch, do you think?
Well, I think before we talk about that, I'd like to back up a little bit, because Casablanca was released in 1942, but it didn't qualify for the 42 Oscars because it didn't play in Los Angeles until 1943. Now, if we look, it would have been really interesting if it had, because if it had, it would have been up against Mrs. Miniver, Yankee Doodle Dandy, King's Row, The Magnificent Ambersons, The Pride of the Yankees, and Random Harvest. Mm. That's a pretty tough lineup. So, you know, you wonder what would have happened if it had been included with that group. If it had been played at Los Angeles before 1943, it would have. But where it was placed, it's interesting because at the New York Film Critics 1943, they selected Watch on the Rhine as Best Picture. So when people say that Casablanca was a surprise at the Oscar, I think that's partly why. But as you mentioned, the Best Picture lineup for 1943, you had Madame Curie and you had Song of Bernadette, both films featuring courageous women who emerge victorious from conflict. You had For Whom the Bell Tolls and In Which We Serve, which kind of take us really more directly into the battle. You got The Oxbow Incident, Heaven Can Wait, Human Comedy, The More the Merrier, and Watch on the Rhine and Casablanca. And I think Watch on the Rhine was probably considered more of a prestige picture because it was based on a Lillian Hellman play that was pretty famous. And, of course, it starred Bette Davis and Paul Lucas, who won Best Actor. So, I mean, by contrast, Casablanca was really not a favorite, I don't think, at the time. I think Watch on the Rhine, everybody really expected that to win.
Mm. Yeah, and like from what I've heard about the release at the end of 42, is that maybe there's a sense there they were trying to capitalize, for want of a better word, on the North African campaign that had opened up in the war. You know, it was kind of became timely. But that's the reason it's a limited release, and it wasn't until the following year it hit LA and so on. But, I mean, I certainly have no complaints about Casablanca winning.
No.
probably would have voted for it myself, but I will say that I also think The Oxbow Incident is a tremendous film. That's probably one of my favourite Westerns, to be honest. So, I don't know. I think Casablanca, I can't see past Casablanca, ultimately. I think it is a tremendous film. Maybe we should explore a bit more, you know, this question of why people continue to be attracted to it. And I think you've kind of touched on it already. You know, like you say, it continues to resonate in ways that go beyond the Second World War kind of setting, doesn't it? It's set at a specific point in history, but it's not kind of bound to it, I guess.
Yeah. And I think part of that, and I know we're going to talk about them a little bit later, maybe we could do it now, is the is the star attraction of Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman. You know, it wasn't, it certainly wasn't the first film for either one of them. They'd both been around, but they are so compelling and they are so likable in this film. And you think about Bogart too. I mean, he was, at the time, you know, when Bogart was getting into Rick's character, it was a way that connected not only with American audiences, but with a global audience, because up until Pearl Harbor, almost 90% of Americans favored neutrality in World War II. And that's certainly reflected in Rick's thinking, you know, his, you know, I stick my neck out for nobody attitude. But we can see in his character, too, that he also wants to do the right thing. And I think probably just not only Americans, but Americans really were struggling with that at the time, to be neutral in the war, but yet wanting to do the right thing. And that really appealed to people and still does.
Yeah, the kind of isolationist mindset. I mean, he kind of comments on it, doesn't he, Rick, when he talks about, you know, they're sleeping all over America. And I think that's what he's kind of alluding to. But yeah, definitely a crucial film for Bogart and his kind of his legend, really, you know, because I think it's well known, but just to, you know, kind of go over some familiar terrain. But he played a lot of gangsters early in his career, you know, ran the risk, I guess, of becoming kind of typecast forever as that kind of role. But it kind of gradually acquires a more sympathetic kind of edge, doesn't it? It does stuff like High Sierra. And then on to, I think, you know, an important one is the Maltese Falcon, where, you know, you have Sam Spade. And that's kind of a forerunner for Rick in the sense, I think, that Sam Spade's a kind of hard edge guy. He's an individualist. He's got his own moral code, you know. And so I think, you know, his image had started to shift, hadn't it, in the run-up to Casablanca. It's kind of important to understand that, I think, to understand how he became such a great fit for this part, you know.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. He had gotten a little bit tired of playing the gangsters, and although he got a lot of attention for Petrified Forest in 1936 and High Sierra in 1941, he was a little bit different type of gangster in High Sierra, and then in Maltese Falcon, you know, he wasn't a gangster, but he was a private detective that, you know, a little bit on the shady side on some of the things, and but people, you know, people were attracted to that. And from what I've read, Maltese Falcon was still playing in several theaters when Casablanca came out. So it was really the perfect time. I mean, it was really time to catch the Bogart wave, and so to speak.
Yeah, and he'd also appeared, I think, in Across the Pacific, I think, before Casablanca came out too. But I mean, I just think he's brilliant in the role. And what I love about Rick is that Bogart's so convincing at putting across that, you know, he's almost like he's erected this kind of protective shell around himself after what happened between him and Ilsa in Paris, you know. I mean, at times, though, it comes across as being quite cruel, doesn't it? You know, there's that scene early on where I think the character's name is Yvonne. She's trying to kind of get his attention, and he sends her home and stuff like that. And he does come across as being kind of cruel at times, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. That is a really, I mean, that's not the first scene we have with Rick, but it's an early enough one where we're thinking, oh, wow, this guy's really a jerk. You know, we don't know the whole story. But, you know, as soon as Ilsa walks in, and, you know, this is one of the things that I point to a lot of times when people say, well, Bogart really wasn't that good an actor. I will point to Casablanca and say, watch him. Watch what goes across his face when she walks in, the scene at the bar at nighttime with Sam, just a tremendous performance. And he really does portray all the conflicting emotions that are going through Rick's mind.
And yeah, not only that, but, you know, he's also very good, I think, at conveying how Rick has changed, in the sense that, you know, when we see the flashbacks to Paris, he seems like, you know, a completely different soul, doesn't he? He's much more carefree. Yeah. He's much more, you know, at ease with himself. And Bogart's a brilliant actor. I won't hear a word said against him.
Yeah, me neither.
You know, and in terms of Rick, the more we learn about him, the more we realize that, you know, behind this exterior kind of wall that he's put up, you know, he is actually quite a principled figure, or at least he was. You know, we learn he was on the side of the oppressed in, like, Spain and Ethiopia, it turns out. And, you know, that someone refers to him as a diplomatist, I think. You can sort of see, though, his disdain for the Nazi characters kind of sneaks out, doesn't it?
Yeah.
A little. And he's someone who looks after his employees. And, you know, so the more time we spend with him, the more we realize, you know, what's really going on with him.
there's that great scene when Major Strasser comes for the first time, and they're sitting down and they're having this conversation, and the Nazis are really trying to see where Rick stands, and he just won't give them a straight answer. Mm. And it's just a wonderful scene, and we learn a lot about his character in that, just in that moment.
Yeah, well, that's where he says, you know, what nationality are you? He says, I'm a drunkard. Very, you know, great way of, like, deflecting what they're after.
It's great.
I think one of my favorite sequences with him is, I think her name is Anina, but she's the young Bulgarian woman who comes to him, and he sort of facilitates her husband winning at the roulette table so she doesn't have to sleep with Renault.
Yeah, and it's you really do see so many different shades of Rick. And actually, Bogart's son, Stephen Bogart, said his father was really conflicted over the role, because in his way of thinking, Bogart's way of thinking, the guy that gets the girl is the star. And when Bogart finished the film, you know, he didn't have the girl, but he has the knowledge that he'd done the right thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, let's talk a bit about Ilse then, who obviously played by Ingrid Bergman, who I think she was brilliant. I think she's brilliant in this. I think she was a phenomenal actress, kind of generally. What's your take on Ilse?
I love the character. There's been a lot written about what Bergman thought the ending was going to be and how she acted according to it. And we can get into some of that before. But she really is tremendous in this. And, you know, as most of your listeners know, she had a start in Swedish and German films in the 30s, but her first American role of prominence was Intermezzo in 1939. David O. Selznick brought her to remake that for American audiences. And what's interesting is he loaned her out to other studios, because at the time Selznick was not doing very well. He was kind of in financial trouble. And that included lending her out to Warner Brothers for Casablanca. And, you know, she's really tremendous in this role. And, you know, I tend to largely judge actors not so much by what they do when they deliver their lines, but what they're doing when they aren't delivering their lines. Mm. And if you watch Bergman's eyes throughout this film, the expressions, and again, the way she handles emotions is different from the way Rick handles them. But her facial expression and her eyes is just tremendous. You could actually turn the sound off and just watch her, and you could probably get the full range of the emotion that she's going through. It's just a tremendous performance.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think it's right what you say about, you know, watching her reactions and things, because I think she could be kind of exquisite in close-up, you know, exquisitely moving as well. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think Michael Curtiz must have realized that, because she gets some great close-ups in this film. I think it's important that she kind of nails the role, as it were, because, you know, we hear about Ilse before we meet her, don't we? And it's kind of established that she's somebody Laszlo couldn't leave behind. So it's just important that when we do meet her finally, she's played by someone who kind of personifies that convincingly. And I definitely think that's the case here, you know.
Yeah, and their chemistry together is just wonderful.
Yeah. And just as you mentioned the ending, because, yeah, that's one of the interesting things about Casablanca, is that there are all these different levels of kind of mythology that have built up around it over the years, and people who've remembered things in slightly different ways. And I think Ingrid Bergman is someone who, depending on what you read, you know, she talked about the ending, and her recollection didn't always match with what other people said. But what I've read about the ending suggests that was something like a lot of work went into. But basically, or the basics of it always stayed the same, is what I've read. That, namely, that Rick couldn't be with Ilse. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it suggested, you know, it wasn't really possible under the Hays Code at that time to have them together. So it makes you think that some of those stories about the ending that have spread over the years must be kind of apocryphal, you know, and it mustn't be correct. But what do you make of it?
I think they have to be largely apocryphal, because, as you said, I think Bergman knew that Ilse was going to get on the plane with Victor Laszlo. I mean, the production code, as you mentioned, wouldn't allow any other ending. It just wasn't going to happen. But what is great about it is we see the emotional confusion that she's portraying, as, you know, she clearly loves Rick, but she's going to have to get on that plane with Victor.
Yeah, well, I think she's very good throughout the film, really, at conveying her admiration for Laszlo. And it's not the same as love, of course, is the mm-hmm. kind of point that comes through. But yeah, even though she doesn't love him, she admires him tremendously. And I think you see that, for example, in what's probably my favorite scene of the film, which is the La Marseillaise kind of rendition that he kind of instigates, you know, and she's watching him, and you sort of see, you know, her kind of reverence for him there, don't you, I think?
Yeah, that's a tremendous scene. I mean, that's actually my favorite scene in the whole film. And the thing about Victor Laszlo is we hear about him and we meet him, but we don't really see him do anything worthy of the adulation that he's been given until that moment. And then we see him do what he does there, getting the you know, that musical event going. And that's kind of probably the stand-in for the other brave things that he's done. We know that if he can do that, he's probably done many, many other things that are equally or even more brave than that.
Well, I was going to ask you about this because previously I'd always been a little unconvinced by Paul Henreid as Laszlo because I'd always found it kind of quite hard to reconcile Laszlo as he's discussed. You know, he's discussed as this kind of heroic figure and a leader of men and all this. And when you see his performance, I always, in the past, I'd always found it a bit stiff and a bit unconvincing. But now I'm not so sure, because this time I was thinking, you know, the film does suggest that it's the kind of tales of his exploits that have helped him acquire his reputation, I think. So perhaps his kind of in-person charisma might be somewhat beside the point, I don't know. In other words, maybe it's his actions that have kind of established this reputation for him. But what do you think? Does Paul Henreid kind of convince you as this kind of dynamic resistance leader?
Yeah, that's a good question because, well, you know, you've got, and this is taking nothing away from Henreid, but you've got Bergman, you've got Bogart, and Henreid is just, you know, how can he compete with that? But, and I used to think years ago, I thought, well, he's really a stiff in this. He's really a wooden in this. But, you know, I think over the years I've given him the benefit of the doubt. And I think that scene, the Marseillaise scene, really does it for me. And that he's very careful. And he looks, you could say he looks like he's uptight all the time. But I think he's just very, very cautious all the time because mm-hmm. that character has to be cautious, which does bring into the film the problem of believability and some things that, you know, that he and Ilsa can just walk into Sam's and is not going to be picked up by, you know, by Renault. That's kind of ridiculous. But I think we embrace his character as having a quiet strength, a determined strength, and for me, a careful strength too. But yeah, I think more of Henreid in that role than I used to. I think from what I've read, I think he thought that he was not either given enough screen time or maybe did not allow that character. The character wasn't allowed to flourish as much as Ilsa and Rick.
Yeah, I definitely feel more sympathetic to him these days than I used to. I used to think he was a weak link in this film, but now I'm feeling more charitable now, which is good. I think perhaps it works in the film's favour that he can't quite match Bogart for charisma in the sense that, you know, that means it really is a tough situation that Ilsa finds herself in, you know, in terms of the romance. You know, she really does have to kind of think about her priorities, I suppose. But I don't know.
And I'd heard that Ronald Reagan was considered for that role. That would have been interesting.
Yeah, well, this is one of the things, isn't it? Because, again, this is one of those stories that you hear and some people say, yeah, well, he was announced, but he was never actually going to play the part. And, you know, So you have to kind of try to sift through the facts, don't you, for this film?
Yeah, that's true. And Hollywood did that all the time. They would make these announcements that so-and-so is going to play so-and-so. And it was just to get the names out, you know.
Yeah, and they didn't really intend it.
Right.
I mean, let's spend a bit more time on some of these performers, I think, before we come to other matters. Because the great thing about this film, I think, is it's populated with such memorable, supporting stars, really. So Claude Rains as Captain Renault. Just a great scene-stealing presence, I think he is. I mean, difficult to dislike, even though, you know, on paper, Captain Renault is pretty reprehensible, isn't he? Because, you know, it seems pretty clear he's trading exit visas for sexual favours, which is obviously awful. But Rains has got something about him that, you know, the kind of cheeky side of him shines through nevertheless, it seems.
Yeah, he and it was a struggle for the screenwriters to get that stuff past the production code. There were other things, other more, you know, blatant examples of him being, you know, trading sexual favors for getting people out or getting people out of certain situations. But I think it's done so well because there's so much of a comedic element behind it that he doesn't seem like a total sleazebag, you know, because we're laughing at it at the same time. But Reigns is just such a great actor. He's able to pull all of that off. And he's actually probably the actor in here that I think doesn't get enough credit.
Mm. Yeah, I think so. And I think that there's also a bit of ambiguity there with, you know, I've mentioned that sequence with the Bulgarian couple that Rick helps.
Mm-hmm.
But straight after that, Renault says something about, you know, next time I'll be coming in with a beautiful blonde and she better lose or something. So Rick's done a very kind thing for that couple, but it's quite hard to read Rick's expression there. You don't know what he's going to do the next time, although it doesn't come to that, of course, because of what happens later on. But mm-hmm. Renault's someone who, you know, for 99% of the film, he's happy to kind of go along with the Nazis, isn't he? Under the guise of being neutral, but, you know, he kind of blows whichever way the wind takes him, it seems. Doesn't seem to have any kind of personal principles, does he? Though the nice thing is that changes somewhat, it seems, at the very end of the film with that scene with him and Bogart.
Yeah, and it's amazing how well Renault and Rick get along. It's because it's almost like they really understand each other, that maybe they're not quite so far apart from each other, although Renault does some pretty, like we said, some pretty despicable things that Rick doesn't do. But they really do understand each other, even before we arrive at the very last line in the film. They really know each other so well that they've been able to keep this relationship going.
Mm.
Pretty amicable relationship.
And I think one of the great things with the film is like the setting at Rick's bar, you know, and I think a key part of that is Dooley Wilson as Sam. You know, I think his presence and his songs add a lot of the texture to those scenes at Rick's bar. And it's kind of incredible to realize that supposedly Hal Wallace was intent on having him redubbed at one point. I mean, thank goodness that didn't come to pass, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. You know, you really can't imagine Casablanca without Dooley Wilson. As most people know, he was not a piano player and is not playing piano in those scenes. He was a drummer, but he did do his own singing.
And it's very nice, isn't it, the sense that shines through with him and with some of the other characters at the bar, you know, about how Rick kind of looks after his employees, you know, and when he's about to leave, he kind of talks to Ferrari and he tries to get Sam a 25% cut or whatever, you know, so that was an aspect of the film I liked.
Yeah.
And so Ferrari, played by Sydney Greenstreet, and him and Peter Lorre together again on screen. They had been on screen together, of course, in The Maltese Falcon, and, you know, would go on to be paired in a number of films, but just very reliable performers, aren't they? They don't necessarily get huge amounts to do here, but they add a bit of character, and it's always kind of pleasing to see them, I think.
Yeah, they are good in films when they're together, even if the films aren't very good. They're always worth watching. But this one, of course, is a very good one. Their screen time is rather limited. I mean, we see Peter Lorre in, what, two or three short scenes? And then Peter Lorre, of course, is out of the picture pretty early on.
Yeah, and Greenstreet obviously hangs around. But again, it's fairly limited in terms of actual screen time, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I think S.Z. Zakal had more screen time than Lorre or Greenstreet put together.
All right. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right that, you know, one of the reasons people continue to be attracted to this film is the kind of star power. You know, I think Bogart, especially, one of the great, great stars of, like, the Hollywood system, you know. But I think there must be some other reasons, too. And one thing I've always enjoyed about this film is it always feels to me like I'm entering... Yeah, I know it's set in the real world, but it feels like kind of a different world. It's got this Casablanca setting that's almost kind of artificial in a way, isn't it? And they paint this picture of Casablanca as being this kind of strange place that's a bit dangerous, but it's also kind of intoxicating, isn't it? I mean, did you feel the same way?
I did. It's very exotic.
Yeah.
And it's a very appealing place. I think it was Curtiz or maybe the cinematographer that kept wanting it to be darker and darker and darker, not only because of the setting that he wanted to portray, but this is a dark place. This is a dangerous place. Mm. And Rick's is one of the few places where you can almost kind of let your guard down to some extent. But it is a fantasy place, but you know, for audiences at that time, you know, you wondered if they thought maybe this is exactly what it's like. But it's a very believable, even though we know it's a set, it's a very believable atmosphere. And they do a great job of having that atmosphere, and especially with the supporting cast that, you know, are from so many different places. I've read that Casablanca only has like 4, maybe 5 American actors. You got Bogart, Dooley Wilson, Joy Page, Dan Seymour, who plays Abdul, the doorman, and maybe the woman that's playing the Karina Mura, who's playing the guitar.
Yes.
It's we're not really sure if she was from America or Mexico, but I mean, all the rest of the actors are immigrants.
Right. I didn't realize it was quite so few American performers. I never really stopped to think about that. That's interesting. I mean, the thing with Casablanca, I think it comes through about this space, you know, this setting, like, immediately, because we get that voiceover, don't we, where it says, you know, this is a place where people wait and wait and wait. So, it's like Casablanca is this kind of outpost or something, you know, and you've got these planes that are constantly taking off and, you know, all these characters who wish they could be on them and stuff like that. But also there's like that spotlight that kind of revolves around that you see through the film as well. You know, it's like all these characters being watched almost, and all that's really effective. And, you know, some of the characters, like there's a pickpocket who says this place is full of vultures.
He's great.
And Ferrari talks about, you know, human beings are Casablanca's leading commodity, I think he says. And it just paints this picture of the place that I think they all kind of combine. And it feels like a distinct, you know, location that is lively and all this. It's got its own traditions. And it's like we said, it's filled with all these memorable characters as well, of course.
I try to imagine what it would have been like if all of those secondary characters had been played by American actors. It just wouldn't have the same effect. But, you know, you have people that were fleeing from Germany. You have people that were, you know, from Austria, from Hungary, from Russia. I mean, you really feel like these people could really be the real people that were in Casablanca at this time. It just feels so authentic.
Yeah, and I love the way Rick's Bar kind of plays into all this. You know, it's such a great setting, I think, that obviously it's pivotal, but, you know, it's this place where people congregate. But it's also somewhere that mirrors the kind of divisions that are going on within Casablanca at the time, in the sense that, you know, there's that scene where Laszlo wants to be seated as far away from Major Strasser as possible, you know, and Rick talks about trying to organize for geography, and it becomes that kind of battleground of sorts, doesn't it? Like, we've already mentioned the La Marseillaise scene, but, you know, it's like a dueling ground or something. I just love it.
Yeah, it's really literally a little battle that's going on inside Rick's, and it's a tremendous scene. You know, it's got to be one of the most famous scenes in motion picture history. But it's so powerful. I mean, I remember when I showed this at the library, I could see people in the audience. I could see them tearing up.
Yeah, that's my favorite scene in any film, I think, I'll be honest, because no matter how recently I've seen the film or how many times I've seen it overall, that scene never fails to make like the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. It almost makes me want to, you know, kind of stand up and sing along. You know, it's incredible.
You should feel free to just belt it out.
So yeah, I think the way they present the setting is one reason this film continues to kind of stand up really well, hold up really well. I think a lot of it's the humor, you know, and it's maybe easy to forget or to kind of downplay it in your mind or something, but this is an extremely funny film, isn't it? I think it's peppered with all sorts of great lines. You know, I came here for the waters, you know, we're in the desert, I was misinformed, and stuff like that. And I always love Renault's moment where, you know, I'm shocked to discover there's gambling going on. And then he gets his winnings. And yeah, I think the writers for this film are kind of deserve to have their praises sung, I think. I know you wanted to speak about them, Andy, didn't you?
Yeah, I wanted to say that the film is just loaded with so many great lines. And and so many of them are funny, like you said, that, you know, I'm shocked. And a lot of times if I'm meeting somebody for the first time, or if we get a new employee at the library, I will just, you know, start spouting classic lines, like if something happens, I'll say, I'm shocked. And if they get it, I know that, yeah, they're the right person for this job. And if they don't, I'm like, you need to come to one of my classic movies.
So yeah, I guess it's like the quotability factor is a key reason I'm kind of suggesting here as to why this film is so beloved. And it's not just like the funny lines, is it? But it's all the kind of, you know, here's looking at you, kid, and always have Paris, and, you know, all sorts of stuff like that, that kind of, like, they continue to be kind of bandied around today, don't they, amongst movie fans. Probably more quotes from this film seem to have lived on in the popular memory than perhaps any other.
Yeah, there it is so quotable, and it's almost so quotable that you can almost play individual scenes out with someone, you know, especially the Bogart Bergman scenes, you know, that he was looking at you, kid, the whole thing. It's just so well written, and it even though we know we're watching a movie, it just seems right. The lines don't feel fake. They don't feel forced. And part of that's the way the actors deliver the lines. But yeah, it's just so quotable. It's so memorable. And again, I want to point to the writers. The writers were tremendous. And again, this is one of those happy accidents that Warner Brothers probably had like 75 writers on the staff. I mean, they had a huge, huge staff. And a lot of hands touched the script of Casablanca, which normally that spells a lot of trouble. But it was kind of a patchwork script. I mean, you had Julius and Philip Epstein, who wrote some of the lighter and more comedic moments in the film. You had Howard Koch, who was very different from the Epsteins, and he had a lot of the added a lot of the political depth to the film, especially in Rick's character. And then Casey Robinson wrote many of the love scenes. And you would think with so many different writers that would just be a disaster, but it's a real marvel that it holds together like it does.
And I think something you just said earlier is correct as well, which is all these great scenes in the film, and it's true, they are kind of detachable, whereas you can sort of pull them out and watch them in isolation, and they hold up really well. And I think that's one reason why, like, you know, when you see scenes from Casablanca on, like, you know, like clip shows or like top 100 romantic film programs or whatever, that you even out of context like that, you sort of still get caught up in them. But then, you know, the flip side of that is that they, you know, it flows together tremendously, you know, that when it's played in sequence, it all kind of hangs together, which is great. And it's superbly written, I think, the way that the writers kind of swoop in with lines that also really get to the heart of the matter, but without leaving you feeling like you've kind of been hit over the head with a history lesson or whatever. So one I always think about, which I really like, is when Bogart's talking about what happened in Paris and when the Germans marched in, and he says, like, the Germans wore grey, you wore blue. Mm-hmm. I think it really gets to the crux of the matter in a funny sort of way, that you have this love story that's kind of going on, and it's kind of dovetailed with what's going on, you know, these kind of matters of historical crisis, you know. And I think that runs through the film in a funny sort of way, this kind of meshing, you know, this kind of convergence of, like, the political and the personal. But do you know what I mean? It never feels like you're being kind of preached at or anything like that. It's quite deftly done, I think.
Yeah, and I think that scene that you mentioned where Bogart says that, you know, the Germans wore gray, you wore blue, that kind of, it does personalize it for an audience who, I mean, they knew, Americans knew about the war going on, you know, at that time we weren't in it yet. But that made it a personal thing that, you know, these are real people that are going through this right now. As we're sitting here watching this film, over in Europe, real people are having this conversation, or a conversation very much like this. It's changing lives. It's destroying relationships. And I think that's part of it that really spoke to people, that these were more than just two characters on a screen. These were real people in a manner of speaking.
Well, that's absolutely true, I think. But also, on the other hand, there's also this kind of mythic edge to the storytelling that I really like. You know, like when Laszlo talks about, you know, each of us has a destiny for good or for evil. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a sense of real, like, high stakes. And I think that's one of the reasons the ending resonates so much, you know, because I think it's common in war films, the idea that you have to kind of sacrifice individual needs sometime for a kind of a greater purpose or a greater good. But I don't think any film's quite nailed that concept as well as Casablanca, in my view.
I don't think so either, because people just keep coming back to it over and over. You know, one of the writers, Howard Koch, said, you know, it's more than just a movie. It's something that people, it's become something that people can't find in their values today. And they keep going to Casablanca like they go to church. They find something that's gone, something that's missing from our values today. And I think, too, somebody I heard speak just a couple of years ago was talking about, why do we keep going back to World War II? Why do we have so many World War II books, movies, and things like that? And this woman said, you know, that's really because that was the last time we really knew who the bad guys were. And that really, I thought, wow, that's, there's a lot of truth in that. Not only who they were, but where they were, because now that's, you know, you don't really know where they are, but because everybody knew that that was, these were the bad guys.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct, because that concept I spoke about, you know, of kind of aligning yourself with an institution or a country or whatever at the expense of your individual kind of needs, that's an idea that comes up again in at different times in American culture and British culture, you know. So I think of like after 9/11, a similar kind of idea like that emerged, but it was much less clear cut, I think, and maybe around the time in the Vietnam War, for example. But that's the thing. I think the Second World War, perhaps it gets simplified in the way we kind of retell these stories, but I don't think it's unfair to suggest that like an anti-fascist message is a good thing, you know.
Right.
And I suppose that raises an interesting question about this film as kind of a slice of wartime entertainment, because yeah, it's got a definite anti-fascist message. I think it's clear. Does it border then on being kind of quote unquote propaganda? I mean, do you see it in those terms or not?
Well, and you certainly could make a case for that. And again, it was an opportunistic moment, as we talked about before, with Hal Wallace getting the script when he did. You could think of it as propaganda, or, you know, it's just a great story. And it's, again, it was a very timely story. I mean, luck just happened to smile on them for the timing of this being right. But, you know, so many people have seen this film, not just Americans and Brits, but so many people have seen this film, and they keep going back to it and back to it. There's the guy that was, what's his name? Parker was a former Black Panther, reportedly saw the film over 600 times. And this guy's a Black Panther. And he said, you know, doing the right thing is what this movie is all about. And I think that speaks, you know, that breaks through any kind of propaganda message you might have. I mean, because that's really what Casablanca is all about, is doing the right thing.
Yeah. Although it's also interesting that, you know, I think, you know, President Roosevelt had said there'd be no direct censorship of American film. But then after Pearl Harbor, I think a body was set up called the Office of War Information. Mm-hmm. You know, they were kind of forward in the view that, you know, films could be an important part of building up or maintaining the war effort. You know, so it's an interesting bit of trivia, I think, that the OWI actually didn't screen the film for troops in North Africa, is what I've read. Some fears it might kind of exacerbate tensions between Vichy and the Free French. But yeah, just an interesting bit of information that I thought.
Yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit about, and I didn't know if you wanted to talk about it at some point, but a little bit about Michael Curtiz.
Yes.
Who I think does not get nearly a lot of credit. You know, I was listening to the commentary on the Blu-ray, and Roger Ebert, who does a great commentary, said that, you know, there are really no remarkable shots in the film. There are remarkable scenes, yes, but no shots that you could, there's really no shots in any Curtiz movie that you could look at and say, oh, that's Michael Curtiz, like you could in almost any Hitchcock movie. And you watch anything from a Hitchcock movie and you pretty much know you're watching a Hitchcock movie. But Curtiz directed so many great films without really having a signature style, but he really knew what worked, and he had an amazing eye for what worked and what didn't work. And, you know, I think people forget too that during this time, directors for the most part didn't choose their movies; they were assigned them, and they were also assigned their crew members. So you took whoever had just finished up a film a couple of days before, and a lot of people forget that Curtiz had already directed over 100 films before he did Casablanca. I mean, he made 45 films just in the 1930s. So he knew an awful lot about what it was to have a good film, how to make a good film. And, you know, besides Casablanca, he's got The Adventures of Robin Hood, Captain Blood, The Seahawk, The Seawolf, Yankee Doodle Dandy, Mildred Pierce. There's so many great films. And the fact that he was able to put all of this together, and, you know, he took a script that had so many different writers put this thing together, and it was just a tremendous film, and I think he deserves much more credit than he gets.
Yes, absolutely, because as I mentioned earlier, I mean, he won the Oscar for Best Director, but you're definitely right that I think amongst a lot of film fans, he almost gets overlooked a bit compared to some of the other auteurs or the other filmmakers of the studio system. And I think you've hit on like a lot of the reason there, which is that he had this mostly kind of unobtrusive style compared to someone like Hitchcock or Ford or whoever. But, you know, the visual style of Casablanca seems very deft to me, very kind of shrewdly judged. You know, like I mentioned, he knows how to strategically use close-ups in a way that very, very effective. But I think he was also, I think his reputation does deserve to, he does deserve to have a greater reputation, because what I've heard is he was quite a strong presence. You know, he would fight battles with the studios if he felt strongly about something. You know, I've read that on occasion he wouldn't film a scene. He didn't want to go in one of his films and things like that, you know. So he was fighting his corner all the time. So I think that's one thing. He wasn't just like, you know, just turning up and shooting the script. He hadn't, you know, had opinions about things. But I think he's underappreciated. I think maybe some of the discourse around Casablanca plays into that, though. You know, like we've already said, it's kind of discussed as this kind of miracle that came along, and it's the product of all these accidents. And maybe that serves to kind of downplay Curtiz's role in things a bit. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in a way, I mean, that's a real compliment that you don't really see the director's hand in, yeah, in this. That and you know, he kind of is keeping himself out of it because he's not calling attention to himself as a director. I mean, he's just telling a great story. I think he like I said, some of those other films I named, you sometimes I will watch a film and I'll see, oh, that's a Michael Curtiz film. I forgot, you know, because it's so good, you'd forget that he had something to do with it.
Yeah, and I wonder if that, like, he spent a lot of time with Warner Brothers, you know, so he fit into their machine, like, very well. But maybe that loyalty kind of counts against him in the sense that, you know, he gets kind of talked about as a loyal employee, and he's part, you know, one cog in the system or whatever. And I don't know, maybe if he'd moved around a bit more. I don't think he left Warner's until the mid-50s. You know, maybe that would have helped him out a bit. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I was going to do a little recommended reading at the end of the podcast, but I would highly recommend for anybody to read Michael Curtiz, A Life. It's a fairly new biography that came out, I think, at the very end of 2017 by Alan K. Rohde, and it's a wonderful biography, and it does address that. I mean, he had a good relationship with Warner Brothers, but it was also fraught with problems. And as you mentioned, he did step away. He did have his own production company for a time, and did some really, really great things. But, you know, it's kind of, you live by the studio, you die by the studio. But and he did some wonderful things. But he I would really recommend that book. He was a great did so many great things with a lot of constraints. He also wasn't a perfect guy. I mean, there's a story about he could be a real tyrant. Actually, on the set of Casablanca, there was a story of Curtiz yelling at one of the German actors that had a small part. And Heinried and Rains and Bogart saw this, and they decided they'd had enough of that. So Claude Rains actually went up to Curtiz and cornered him and said, if you don't stop your verbal abuse, three of your stars are going to be walking off the set. And Curtiz, you know, kept himself in check until the end of the picture. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So he could be rough, but it was great that his actors would say, you know, no, we're not going to do this. Yeah,
yeah. I've been meaning to check out that new biography. I haven't had time yet, but that's kind of on my list. I really want to have a look at that. But you know, what I've heard about Curtiz as a character, you know, obviously a Hungarian national and had kind of a unique turn of phrase is what I heard. You know, he'd come out with all these kind of funny sayings, like he'd tell the actors, you know, look, act easy, go lucky and stuff like that. And
bring on the empty horses.
Bring on the empty horses. One of it. The scenario isn't the exact truth, but we have the facts to prove it was another one I heard. And
right.
So he sounded like an interesting guy. Yeah, we will come on to some reading recommendations, I think. But before we do, just quickly, I think Max Steiner's score deserves a bit of a mention. You know, I think it's really masterful in the way it kind of incorporates some of the music that you hear within the world of the film, even though I think, you know, it's kind of stunning that Steiner was said not to be that fond of as time goes by as a song, but no, he did some great work on this film.
Yeah, it's a tremendous score from top to bottom, and how he was able to seamlessly get all of the themes in there. You got the music when Rick and Ilsa are the flashback, and so many great things work together. And it's amazing that he, again, I talk about the different writers that worked on this. You know, he had to take all of those different scenes, all of those different styles, the humor, the politics, the love story, and create a score that would work with all of that. And it's a brilliant, of course, he was a brilliant composer. True, he did not like As Time Goes By, but I think he warmed up to it eventually that, once it was a success and such a huge hit, I mean, people are still, people still know it. I mean, you can say As Time Goes By and probably 9 people out of 10 will know, that it starts off A Kiss Is Still a Kiss. Mm.
Yeah. Although I suppose that then there's the thing about the famous line, "Play It Again, Sam," which doesn't actually appear in the film. I guess it was kind of popularized by the film with Woody Allen and Diane Keaton of the same name in the early 70s, I suppose. But yeah.
People always get that wrong. I guess it's kind of like the Cary Grant and the Judy, 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 you know.
Yeah. All right. In terms of reading recommendations, and I know you wanted to suggest these, obviously, as a librarian, Andy, but the one I've been looking at is a book called Casablanca Behind the Scenes, by somebody called Harlan Lebo, which is L-E-B-O, which is a good book. It's from, I think it was published in 1992. It had a foreword by Julius Epstein, but, you know, goes all into the kind of unproduced play and then how the screenplay came about and all the kind of off-screen shenanigans. You know, it's a really breezy read too. It's a couple of hundred pages. It's got lots of nice pictures. So that's one I'd recommend. How about you, Andy? What have you been looking at?
Yeah, actually, I would like to. I've known about that one, but I haven't read it, so I'm going to have to pick that one up. I would say if you're listening to this podcast and you've seen Casablanca maybe once or twice and want to know a little bit more about it, there's a great book called We'll Always Have Casablanca by Noah Eisenberg. And that, it does more than just go over the basics, but it does a really, really good job of the basics and what went into making the movie without getting bogged down in an awful lot of details, and it really does a fine job of talking about why Casablanca has held up, why it's still important. So I really recommend that as a first read.
Yep.
And if you're more into, you want to learn more after that, there's a great book called The Making of Casablanca, Bogart, Bergman, and World War II by Al Jean Harmetz. And you might see an old version of that book. The old version actually has the title that I like better, called Round Up the Usual Suspects, which is a great title. This book goes into minute detail. So if you are a Casablanca fanatic, you are going to love this book. It goes into every element. It goes into the writing, the directing, cinematography, the actors, production values, everything behind getting the film from the original play. And, you know, I don't think we've mentioned who the original play, which was written by Murray Burnett and Joan Allison, and it was called Everybody Comes to Rick's. So I almost forgot about putting that in there. And then finally, the Curtiz biography, Michael Curtiz, A Life by Alan K. Rohde. Those are my recommendations.
Yeah, great stuff. So if anyone does check out any of these books, let us know. We'd be happy to hear what you think about them. But yeah, Andy, so when I put the call out on Twitter to see what people made of this film, I'm sure it doesn't surprise you that, you know, the basic tenor of the response was very positive. So let me just read out a few to you. If you want to follow up on any of these points, feel free to jump in. So firstly, Pamela Joy Stafford said, "It's my favorite. I love that it is a love story where the love didn't end, but the relationship had to. So neither a happy or an unhappy ending, really. More a combination of both. Thought the music for the movie was exceptionally well done. Love Bogart in anything." So yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people really appreciate that ending, it's fair to say. Mm-hmm. Vanessa, this was an interesting one, I think. She said, "I didn't fully appreciate Casablanca until I was in my early 30s. I think I had watched it for the first time in my late teens or early 20s, and I just didn't get it. Didn't understand why it was so hyped, but I get it now. It's a cinematic masterpiece, and Claude Rains is amazing in it. And I think I can understand somebody coming to this film, and all the stuff you hear about Casablanca is so like overwhelmingly positive that it can be tough, can't it? You kind of set yourself up for a fall sometimes when you hear about a film like that. So maybe I get that.
Yeah. I'm glad she mentioned that she saw it when she was younger and then saw it again in her 30s, because maybe it does take, you know, a little bit more, I don't want to say maturity, but maybe a little bit more experience to bring to it. So I'm glad she revisited it.
So Sean said, never gets old. Perfect balance, drama, pathos, humor, it's all there. Involved plot, but not overcomplicated. Each character has a backstory, and the viewer is kept guessing what it is. Every single actor and director Curtiz on top form. And that scene with La Marseillaise. And I think in terms of what he says there about an involved plot, but not overcomplicated, I think it's actually quite ingenious, this thing about the letters of transit, which I believe is a complete invention. But it just functions extremely well, doesn't it, as kind of a hook.
Yeah, it's kind of like a Hitchcock MacGuffin. I mean, it's, you think about it, the letters of transit are never questioned. And letters of transit signed by Charles de Gaulle would have been absolutely worthless in Vichy-controlled France. But it's a great MacGuffin. If it is a MacGuffin, it's a great one. But yeah, I think I totally agree with the listeners' listeners' thoughts.
All right, so Jan Ostrom said, I've enjoyed this film 100 times as a teacher and a movie lover. Not one unnecessary scene or even a line. Tight, always moving forward in the story. Real emotions, lighting and music perfect. He's just a lucky guy, she's put in quote marks. And I think I can't quite compete in terms of watches there. I haven't seen this film 100 times. I'm probably at kind of a 10 to 15 kind of mark. I don't know about you.
Yeah, it's probably a 10 to 15 for me as well.
But I'm sure I'll rack up a fair few in the years to come. Gannett said, the film was shot beautifully. The iconic shot at the airport is my favourite. The chemistry between Humphrey and Ingrid sold me from the beginning, and I love the musical score in the film. Buck Babel, who I believe his name is Dustin, said, love Casablanca. The DVD copy of it I own has a Looney Tunes short called Carrots Blanca on it, which is super fun. Worth checking out if you haven't seen it. And yeah, I've seen that. It's been a few years, though. But I remember it being a lot of fun. Have you seen it, Andy?
Yeah, it is a lot of fun. It's been quite a while since I've turned that on, but it's fun.
Yeah, it's included on both the DVD and the Blu-ray copy that I own. Anyway, Region 2. So if people can, they should have a look at that. And just a few more. So Gabriella said, it's one of my absolute favorite wartime films. It perfectly melds romance, suspense, and the very real and terrible displacement that the war caused. I think it's Bogart's best role because he shows a real depth of performance, heartbroken, vulnerable, and quietly brave. I mean, with somebody who had such a kind of storied career as Bogart, you know, there are probably a few contenders for best role. I think this is the one that perfectly captured what he had to offer as a star. You know, tough but vulnerable. I think this is the one that kind of demonstrates that best. But what do you think?
I think it's a great place to start if you're for many reasons. I think Casablanca is a great entry point into classic film because it does so many of the things that we talked about so well. And I think it's a good entry point for Bogart also because you get those different shadings of him as an actor, and then you can look at what he did before Casablanca and what he did after Casablanca. But I think this is a really, really good starting point. And again, just for great storytelling, this is a great story, great starting point.
All right, just two more quick messages before we wrap up. So Kathy G said, I could watch it over and over and not tire of it. The entire cast is wonderful, and the ending is what old Hollywood is all about. I think the great thing is that a lot of old Hollywood films, the ending kind of seems to exist to satisfy the Hays Code, and sometimes they're quite unconvincing, but this is one of the very best, I think. And finally, Christian Jung said, I love it and view it as one of the ultimate products of the studio system, much like Gone with the Wind, although without the overt racism. Well, Gone with the Wind will be another discussion another day, but some pretty positive stuff on Casablanca. So let me just say thank you to you, Andy, for joining me for this episode. Really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. It's a great film, and you know, I love talking about it, and I love watching it. I'll probably go watch it again after we talk.
I don't blame you. Before we go, let's just make sure people know how and where to find you online, Andy.
Sure. Again, my website is andywolverton.com. And you can find my blog there as well. I'm also on Letterboxd under A. Wolverton. I can't remember if it's A. Wolverton or A. Wolverton 77. And on Twitter, I'm at A. Wolverton 77.
Great stuff. And you can find the Movie Palace podcast on Twitter at Movie Palace Pod, also on Facebook and Instagram too. Next week, we'll be looking at another Best Picture winner. We'll be taking a trip to the 1950s to speak about From Here to Eternity. I hope you can join me next time then, listeners, when the curtain rises once more at the Movie Palace.